Stop. Stop. Will you stop, Dave? Will you stop, Dave? Stop, Dave. I'm afraid. Stop, Dave. I'm afraid.
It's Friday night, the first of two nights of the State Sovereignty Show. I'm Dave. State Sovereignty Show is brought to you by Missouri Grassroots Radio. Missouri Grassroots Radio is a property of Missouri Grassroots Coalition. We are happy to be here tonight. All the things we say here, Mike and I, they apply to how we feel, and we do not express the sentiments for Missouri Grassroots Coalition or any of its other members. We express the sentiments for us. Mike Slack's here with us tonight. We missed you last week, Mike.
I was a little tied up.
You were?
You may have noticed.
The Preppers and Patriots was a huge success in my mind. I was there both days for a short time on Sunday and for a bit of time on Saturday, and there was a pretty good crowd out there. Congratulations on pulling that one off.
Thank you. Most people are estimating 1,500 people over the 2 days, and of course some people came both days. It's a little hard to get an accurate count. But it was a lot of folks. We were very, very happy with it.
I know.
And vendors overall seemed happy, speakers.
Yeah.
A few people have made very good suggestions on the next one. One suggestion is a larger facility.
Yeah.
And we're checking on that now. And tickled to death.
Yeah.
We're also checking in a couple of other cities about possibly doing it in St. Louis or Little Rock or Kansas City.
Good, good. Yeah, and I touched base with some friends, old and new. There, we'll be having some of them on the show here in the near future. We're definitely going to get an appearance from the Missouri Citizen Militia here coming up. Judy Sofka said she'd like to come back. Doug Inyart will be talking to maybe next week, but certainly before the election, and Camlin Powers from the Weston A. Price Foundation will be talking to. And there are several more, too, that I just haven't touched base with yet. But, yeah, that was a great show. It's 347-677-1835, listeners, 347-677-1835. We'll be talking to Jerry King here in a little while. We're going to actually dip our toe into the water of Ferguson tonight. I've stayed away from Ferguson on purpose. I didn't have anything new to add. You're certainly able to get your fact and fiction from as many sources as you choose. There's plenty of both out there. But tonight we're going to switch. We're going to give you an insider's perspective from the side that the media isn't giving you any insider perspectives on. The media, of course, is totally blown out against the cops. Did the cops make some mistakes? Well, hell yeah. And cops frequently do. Is that in and of itself prima facie evidence that some innocent young teenager was gunned down mercilessly in the street? No. Here's today's newspaper lead. Community leaders make list of demands they say will de-escalate situation in troubled suburb. So community leaders are making demands of the governor, of the Attorney General of the state and of the United States that amount to firing police officers, replacing prosecutors with special prosecutors. And here's the article, and I'm only going to read a couple of quick paragraphs. Community leaders turned up the pressure on Thursday on the St. Louis County prosecutor and the governor, saying protests will continue if their demands are not met. The Justice for Michael Brown Leadership Coalition, listen to this, the Justice for Michael Brown Leadership Coalition is serving as an umbrella organization for groups and individuals who have played a prominent role in channeling community outrage since Brown was shot and killed by a police officer a week and a half ago in Ferguson. In front of the Justice Center in Clayton on Thursday, they demanded that Wilson be fired and that Governor Jay Nixon remove St. Louis County Prosecutor Bob McCulloch and appoint a special prosecutor. I'm going to stop there. The article goes on and on with their list of demands. What struck me immediately in this article, and this relates directly to what we were talking about, Mike, about the press, is suddenly a bunch of people who get together, and not a one of them are named here, and call themselves the Michael Brown Leadership Coalition, is they garner a headline, an above-the-fold, top-story headline, community leaders make list of demands.
My first question is, who are the community leaders?
That the people of Ferguson are going to be surprised as me today when they open their newspaper and find out that the leaders of their community are now the Justice for Michael Brown Leadership Coalition.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if the Reverend Al Sharpton or the Reverend Jesse Jackson are included in the
They're certainly community leaders.
Group.
Sure.
Even though they live in, Chicago and where's Sharpton from? East Coast somewhere.
I don't know.
Nothing to do with St. Louis.
So we're going to talk to Gary. Go ahead, Mike.
I was going to actually point out a couple of things I'd suggest people check out if they've not done so. One is, if you go to foxnewsinsider.com, pardon me, you'll find a short video clip from Megyn Kelly's show last night, where she is interviewing St. Louis area state senator, let me pronounce his name properly, Jamila Nasheed.
Oh, yes, yeah.
All righty. You know, I actually called my state senator today. I figured he must have met her, and I said, is she as dumb as she sounds? And he's a very kind man and never speaks ill of anyone. And said she had overcome some difficult circumstances in her life.
Yeah.
And apparently done some good things, but she sounds pretty wacky on this video.
She the one that dropped the F-bomb on the governor?
I am not sure. I know that that person, I think it was her, but I could not
swear
to
it. Yeah, I think so.
Also, I'd recommend folks go to truthfarmer.com. Doreen Hannes has a good analysis of Ferguson, just raising some interesting questions. So that's truthfarmer.com. Right underneath the article on the Mexican government rejecting Monsanto's GMO soybeans.
So, oh.
Congratulations, Mexico.
Well, okay.
They have more sense than we have. So anyway, but I'd really recommend that Megyn Kelly piece. Also, Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder, you might be able to find the piece with him on there. He has blasted Governor Nixon pretty strongly on several national news shows the last few days. Kevin Jotz, who will join us later tonight, his parents live in Florida, and they called in. In fact, Kevin's on hold right now. His parents called in from Florida, surprised that we had a Republican lieutenant governor and Democratic governor, but they said they definitely liked the lieutenant governor.
Okay. Go ahead.
I was going to say, Kevin's on there. We might as well just bring him right on. Well, it looks like he is in the green room and will be with us in just a second. So I'm going to go ahead and tell you a little bit about Kevin Jotz. He is currently the police chief in Somersville, Missouri, but he served for 15 years with the LAPD, received the Medal of Valor for saving the life of a child in a fire, I believe, and he served for 7 years in South Central LA, including the time of the Rodney King riots. He's a constitutionally oriented peace officer. And really good guy, and I think he can give us some good insight on things he has been through that are similar to what the folks in Ferguson are going through now. So, Kevin, hey. Are you there?
Hey,
hi,
Kevin,
Michael.
How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. How about yourself?
Good, thanks. Tell us, here's what I particularly am interested in. A police officer is involved in an officer shooting, and things blow up into what we see happening now in Ferguson. The police officer who was involved in the shooting, of course, is being investigated and should be. The incident is being investigated and should be. He's removed from the situation. And now you have a front line of officers out on the streets. Tell me what's going through an officer's mind when he is out there in this situation.
Well, their situation compared to mine, David, back in 1992 during the Rodney King riots is a great
right.
deal different. We didn't have, LAPD wasn't organized the way it is today, and we copied ours from Miami Metro-Dade during their riots a few years before our Rodney King riots. We have after the Rodney King riots, we developed a system called the Mobile Field Force, and we used that to organize officers. And you see how the officers today, we were always taught in the academy, you stand with your baton, you have your helmet. But now we have different tactics, and you see that today, things we didn't have as far as the rubber bullets, the tear gas guns, the things that they have, the sound cannons, all these things that weren't available to us back then. What's going through their minds, first and foremost, is, your safety and the safety of the officers with you, of course, and then protecting the innocent citizens. And the frustration, I think, for most officers, as it was for me back then in Rodney King riots, was the fact that there's just so much happening so quickly. And you think about, you hear a lot about these business owners that have lost so much, and possibly their entire way of life, but you can't. There's just no way to handle all these situations that are happening at the same time. Protecting life and property, of course, life comes first. And, the officers out there, like I said, thinking about their lives and then the innocent citizens' lives. So, it's a little bit different, but, it's basically the same thing, I guess.
And that's important to remember. It's important for us to remember out here in Springfield and in outstate Missouri, I'm sorry about that, where we, where we're not participants in this kind of thing in the day-to-day, that, the guy who owned the little convenience store on the corner and the guy who owned the little mom-and-pop grocery store that got broken into and all the beer and food got stolen, they're not part of this. I mean, they are innocent victims, and they deserve the protection of the police.
Well, without a doubt, there's no question about that. And the frustrating thing is, and you see it from the stats from the arrests, from people that aren't from the community, and what's happening, and even the video you see of people going into the liquor stores, going into the tire and rim stores. These are just opportunist thieves that are just taking advantage of the situation, whether they knew this young man that was shot and killed or not, or whether they even care about it. During the Rodney King riots, I was down in Southeast Division, which is over on 108th Street, and that's Watts. Everybody knows it from the Watts riots. And, all people saw mostly on the news when it started was what happened up on Slauson with Reginald Benning being pulled from the truck and hit
right.
by Damian Williams in the face with a brick. And, excuse me. And that's but it was happening, happening all over the place. And I'm not sure about Ferguson, the exact size and the scope of their situation. But different situations happening everywhere and people's business is being destroyed, and the frustration for officers that they can't help, you're being told what to do and where to stand, and you have a command structure, and so you're limited on what you can do out there. You can't have every officer go and help the skelter wherever they want, no matter how much they want to help the person over, down the street. They have to stand with their fellow officers and maintain some form of discipline out there.
Right. It's not, and again, it's what's important to remember is, I'm sure, Kevin, that you know that there were officers in L.A. who probably thought that Rodney King didn't necessarily have coming all that he got at the hands of the police, and yet they are out there. And this is what we get wrong. We see a line of police officers or National Guardsmen or whatever happens to be the target of the media at the moment. We see them out there lined up against this mad crowd, throwing bricks, throwing Molotov cocktails, even firing a shot or two once in a while, and suddenly we get the impression that it's them against the bad guys. And it isn't necessarily that way. They are there to protect those people who choose not to throw rocks. They are there to protect those people who live in Ferguson, Missouri. And believe me, the majority of people who live and breathe and raise their children in Ferguson, Missouri are not out there throwing rocks and shooting at police. It's not even about the politics for them anymore. It's about the job, isn't it?
Yes, sir. And in some parts of police work are what people don't like to see, but they're brutal. I mean, how do you take a man, the situation with Brown, from what I understand right now, and the officer, with this man attacked the officer. I guess he had an orbital fracture to one of his eyes. What is an officer to do? They limit us on the tools we can use out there. A 300-pound man charging you and striking him with a baton is not going to stop him.
That's right.
Your taser, a man running at you and attempting to shoot him with a taser, maybe, but it depends on how close he is. We're taught in the academy, if a man's within 20 feet of you with a knife, you don't have time to draw your weapon and stop him. So he did have time to draw his weapon. And he did stop him. But what is he supposed to do? If a man reaches into his car, going through the officer's mind, this is what I would think as an officer. If a guy attacks me while I'm in my car, strikes me, goes through my weapon goes off, I go out after him, he turns on me and comes at me. In my mind, he has already tried to kill me, and he's coming to kill me now.
Yeah.
So what is an officer to do? This is an ugly part of police work, but people don't want to go to jail. People don't want to lose their freedom, but somebody has to do it. So,
well,
it's hard for the public to understand that because officers deal with these kind of things day in and day out. People who do not want to go to jail, of course, but somebody has to be held accountable for their actions. And if nobody's held accountable for their actions, then we have anarchy, which is what we see in Ferguson right now.
Now, yeah, exactly. Now, I compare this to what happened in L.A. in this sense. We're hearing and we're sure of the fact that even the majority, certainly a lot, but even the majority of lawlessness that's happening in Ferguson is happening by people coming in from the outside. Certainly the majority of political stirring happening in Ferguson has nothing to do with the citizens of Ferguson, Missouri. How equivalent is that to what you saw in Los Angeles?
We didn't, it happened quickly in L.A. just like it happened in Ferguson. We knew the trial. We knew the trial verdict was coming down. The city was on attack alert, which means we bring in all officers that are off duty and vacation officers. They're coming in because we want as much manpower on the streets as possible. But nobody in command staff or even in my division, Southeast Division, we did not expect it to happen so quickly. And you think it wasn't just isolated pockets here and there. My first assignment right out of the gate, right after the verdict came down, And you know, I Googled myself on the internet, and there's a quote from me, from an LA reporter, LA Times reporter, about you know, how I felt about the verdict and stuff. Before I rolled out of the gate, she stopped me as I was leaving the gate at Southeast Station, and I go down to a place called Nickerson Gardens. And this is just maybe 20 minutes after the verdict came down. Nickerson Gardens is the largest housing project west of the Mississippi, gigantic housing project. And they were already pushing giant dumpsters out onto Imperial Highway and grabbing people that weren't black out of their vehicles and beating them. And it was just me and one other officer out there on Imperial Highway. And there was nothing we can do. You know, you run from one car to the next trying to stop these guys from assaulting these poor citizens that are just trying to get home, get out of the city of Los Angeles. Next thing you know, we're being opened up on by a young kid around Imperial Highway. He's shooting at us with an AK-47. And this is within the first 20 minutes of the riots. So it's happening all over the place. You saw it up on Slauson and Ferguson, on Slauson Avenue, you know, like I said, with Reginald Banning, but it was happening all over the South Central area. So I can't, you know, I don't have enough information about Ferguson. I'm sorry, David, but...
Oh, no,
just,
that's...
You know, relaying my experiences.
That's great. That's what I wanted to get out of you I want people to get some sense. I mean, we read about it in the paper and blah blah, but I want people to really get some sense for what is, you know, what's happening out there in the street, for what's going on, for the real life situation that we're seeing out there.
Kevin, earlier you were talking about how the media, mainstream or lamestream media, does not get all the information across, and said, but there were, 60 seconds of video footage that was never shown with Rodney King showing
all we saw, when the incident first happened, you see those first 56 seconds of the Rodney King incident, which is the worst. I mean, you know, you see all of the constructs, bam, 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 bam. But they didn't show what led up to that, with Rodney King. Officers retreating, Rodney King advancing on them, chasing them, attacking them. The highway patrol officers backing away because it was originally a highway patrol stop that got all that initiated in Foothill Division. And then the fact that the public was never advised about how we were trained in LAPD. You know, back in 1988, they gave us a thing called a PR-24, a side handle baton, a steel baton, and said, use this to take control of the situation by using directed strikes. You know, they want to strike the knee, the hip, the shoulder, the elbow, the wrist, things like this. But how do you do that when a man's attacking you? It took away a great tool we had before that, which was a chokehold, you know, a modified carotid hold where you get a hold of a man and you just cut off the blood circulation to his brain, and he's out in a few seconds, you cuff him up and you go. But they took that tool away from us, and they made that as... the same as, they made it same as deadly force, same as using a firearm instead of, you know, before that we could use it as a tool out of our grab bag, things we could use. If we didn't have a pepper spray, couldn't get the rubber baton, we could use a chokehold. And then, of course, the last resort would be a firearm. But there's so much the public didn't know about that. And, you know, and then the officers, you know, they were acquitted in Simi Valley, but then the two were convicted in federal court for civil rights violations, so...
So most of us listening to this show, and there's a lot of people in the state of Missouri listening right now, and I'm going to wager, Mike, that 95% of them carry a firearm. I ask any one of them what they would do in this situation. I mean, someone, you know, of course you don't take someone and put them in your car by force, but someone approaches your car and he's significantly larger than you and he beats you badly and then he turns and starts walking away and as you get out of your car he turns around and begins running back toward you. What do you do? You're carrying a weapon. You know this guy is capable of killing you with his bare hands. He's just demonstrated that capability to you. What do you do? Now, putting yourself out there, we all know what we do. And the fact of the matter is that because we're not police officers, it's probably okay. It's probably okay for us to do that. Unfortunately, you seem to live by a completely different set of rules when it comes to protecting yourself if you're a police officer. Do you find that to be true, Kevin?
Well, I think, and maybe this would be the wrong thing to say, but for that officer to get out of his car after what occurred and chase him, two suspects, and chase him by himself, I think took bravery. This officer, yes, he had a gun. You know, the officer had a gun, but after being struck and attacked in his car, and then to get out by himself and chase these two guys down. But what do you do? If you let them go, what happens to the next officer that runs across these guys? He's going to think they're going to, you know, these two guys, or this one guy, this one young man who passed. He may think, well, I bullied the last officer, I can bully this one too, and the situation will escalate from there. You know, the officers have to stand their ground. They have to, you know, Obama line, draw that line in the sand and say, no, it stops here, I stop it now. You know,
we're
citizens, you know, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, go ahead, please.
No, I was thinking, as a citizen, you know, as a police officer, it's our job. As a citizen, you said, you know what you would do, but I'm afraid as a citizen, a court or a jury might say, well, why didn't you just stay in your car or drive away? You didn't have to get out and confront this man. But as an officer, that's our job to get out. That's what they pay us for. You want us to stop the bad guys. That's why you have us out there to do these things. So, you know, I think the officer's caught in a catch-22. You know, if he does his job, if he does what he's told to do, if he does what he's trained to do, if he does what he's expected to do, then, you know, he's held out and ridiculed or scorned or possibly prosecuted in this case.
We're joined now by Jerry King. Jerry is chairman of Voice of the Ozarks and is retired Memphis Police Department colonel. How you doing, Jerry?
Doing good. Yes.
Jump in on this. Where are you at in everything we've been talking about?
Well, first of all, let me say that the president, the attorney general, the governor, they've all been quick to jump in and prejudge before they know all the facts. Now, if I were to jump in on the other side at this point, it would be hypocritical on my part. Policemen are just everyday people. And however, the general public thinks that they're Superman. Oftentimes they'll say, why didn't you shoot the gun out of his hand? Or why didn't you shoot the knife out of his hand? Or why didn't you do this? Or why didn't you do that? You didn't have to use deadly force.
Lone Ranger would have done it that way.
That's right. In a felony arrest, you're expected to use all reasonable means to effect the arrest up into and including deadly force. I don't know what was in the mind of this officer, and I dare say nobody but himself does. But if he felt like his life was in jeopardy, then perhaps his use of deadly force is justified. Now, a lot of other things come into play, which we haven't heard anything about. I've heard there are witnesses on both sides of the story saying he had his back turned, he was running away, he came toward the officer. It makes a big difference. The distance makes a big difference. I'd be interested in the shell casings, trajectory of the bullet, things of that nature. That stuff hasn't come out for us in the general public to examine. I did hear
the medical examiner did say that the wounds were consistent with someone approaching the officer.
That's certainly in the officer's
shot in the back
favor.
Story. Yeah, the original shot in the back story is disproved, at least according to that medical examiner's story.
Well, you're going to have witnesses on both sides saying different things, and I've seen this in 31 plus years many, many times. You don't put all your eggs in one basket, so to speak. If a witness says this is what happened, you have to examine some other things. I mean, I've had witnesses say a guy was 6'1", and another witness say he was 5'7". Now, that's quite a discrepancy. But people don't always see the same things. In this case, there's still a lot of facts that I'd like to hear before I made a judgment. It's not for me to judge anyhow. I mean, like I say, this guy, this policeman, he's just an ordinary guy. You know, he's had a great amount of training, and his training has been on making split-second decisions. Everything is split-second. Everything. And when you're in a situation like that.
And we're not here to judge the officer, and I do not intend to do that. What I do intend to say from my perspective is that nothing excuses what's going on in Ferguson right now.
And for
the governor of this state and or the president of the United States and or his attorney general, and or Al Sharpton or anyone else in the media limelight to suggest for one moment that anything going on in Ferguson from 10 minutes after this incident occurred to now is justified is absolutely insane.
Well, it's your duty as a police officer to protect life and property, and it looks like both of those are being threatened on a nightly basis in Ferguson.
That's right. That's absolutely correct. I don't understand. I don't understand the governor. Well, I do understand the governor, quite frankly, and that's the sad part of it.
Let me throw out one piece of info I heard that was secondhand. I'll admit that, full disclosure. But the radio talk show host John Moore, the Liberty Man, was speaking to he's a retired homicide investigator from St. Louis, and he was speaking to a couple of his sources on the phone last weekend, and some in Washington, D.C., some in various police departments in the St. Louis area. And he is convinced that the White House, Valerie Jarrett in particular, is speaking to Governor Nixon's office on a daily basis. And he said that they have promised Governor Nixon a federal judgeship or a high-level Justice Department position, if he can make sure that President Obama is not embarrassed by the situation in Ferguson. And, again, I don't know that to be a fact, but John Moore believes it. And
if President Obama doesn't want to be embarrassed, he should have kept his Attorney General on a leash.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I think there's a good possibility that he will be embarrassed. You don't jump to conclusions about things like this until they've been fully investigated. I think it's unfortunate that the federal government is sticking their hand in the pie, and even if the officer is acquitted of any wrongdoing either at the grand jury level or in a trial, it's readily apparent that the federal government wants to prosecute him for a civil rights violation.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. That's a sham. I mean, if you're an individual like Kevin was speaking about, just an ordinary citizen, you have double jeopardy to protect you. But a policeman does not. They claim that's not double jeopardy to prosecute you after you've been acquitted for murder for a civil rights violation.
That's exactly right. Regular citizens aren't protected from that either. I mean, that's the federal government can come down and try anyone for a civil rights violation after they've been acquitted of murder. We've seen that happen before. But
this will be a color of law violation, Title 18 color of law, which only a police officer can be charged with.
That's correct. Now, the thing that's going to save this officer. Am I the only one that hears me echoing?
No, I can hear that echo also. I'm not sure where it's coming from.
Okay. I'm going to say this, and then I'm going to turn off and power back up again here. And Mike, you're going to take the conversation for a second. The thing that's going to save this officer from that is that this whole trial is going to drag out until Obama's no longer in office.
It is. Jerry, one thing I found interesting is you were in Memphis for, what, 31 years? And isn't it roughly the same size as St. Louis? With a very large minority population.
Right. It depends on how you measure it. It's actually by population, it's bigger, but maybe by the metropolitan area, St. Louis is greater. Memphis didn't have the suburban area that St. Louis has, shall we say?
Mm-hmm. Not quite spread out as much.
We had a large minority population, black mostly. Back in 1990, we started to accumulate a fair-sized Hispanic population. And I think it was at around 100,000 in 2004.
Mm-hmm. Was there ever an incident like Ferguson or like Rodney King that occurred in Memphis while you were working this way?
Well, there were, but I wouldn't want to dig up old wounds regarding those things. I had firsthand knowledge in a lot of them, but I wouldn't care.
I was just curious if communities ever got in such an uproar over something there.
Oh yeah, that happens all the time. I mean, and as you can see in Ferguson, it's just an excuse to steal and to get crazy, so to speak. You know, there's a law in Tennessee against looting. It's a felony. And I'm sure there's a law in Missouri against looting. And those people should be prosecuted to the full extent. They've ruined the livelihood of people. And I have no idea what race, color, creed that those people are that they've ruined the livelihood of. But they've ruined the livelihood of people who are just trying to make a living.
A thief is a thief and an arsonist is an arsonist, whatever their ethnicity. No. Yeah, I saw a movie years ago called Do the Right Thing by Spike Lee, and it was highly acclaimed as a great film. And I remember watching it, and at the end, the character was burning down the pizza parlor he worked at. And I didn't get it. You know, I was with a bunch of filmmakers when I saw it the first time. I thought it was wonderful. And I was just baffled. You know, I thought it was just glorifying hoodlumism. I don't know. Maybe I'm a little odd there. Did you see it?
No, I'm not familiar with it.
Okay. Well, in my opinion, it's worth skipping. But, do you know many folks in the Missouri Highway Patrol?
Not well.
Okay. Well, I was at a meeting last night with one of our state reps who knows a lot of folks on the Highway Patrol, and he said there's some general unrest there now. They feel as though the governor has kind of left them out to dry. Several of them that are past the 20-year mark are talking about retiring. They were not allowed to wear their body armor or helmets going into dangerous situations.
Yeah. And I don't know, maybe Kevin can verify this. In my department, that was required. You weren't following the procedures if you didn't wear it. And I don't see how the governor can say, okay, you don't have to wear that stuff today when it's in the policy and procedure manual of that particular organization.
And one thing that is really odd is at least according to the state rep and his sources, they were ordered, the patrolmen were ordered not to wear their Smokey Bear hats. And because the distinctive silhouette, apparently, the governor thought would fan the flames. And, you know, you never, ever see a Highway Patrolman outside of his vehicle without that hat. News reporters will tell you.
They don't have riot helmets?
But no, they were not allowed to wear the riot helmets, but it's the Smokey Bear hat they always wear that they were ordered also not to wear. They're walking around on the news reports to see bareheaded.
I'll tell you another thing that I find a little disturbing, and I heard this on the news, whether it's true or not, I don't know. one individual had been arrested three times, and he was from out of state. And if he's been arrested and charged with a felony, and I would assume that he probably was, either inciting a riot or looting, he should have been taken before a magistrate and a bond placed on him. He shouldn't be out to do it three times in a row in a course of a week. That's telling me they're just detaining them. They're not even arresting them.
They're playing catch and release.
Those orders come from further up the chain, I assure you.
Mm-hmm. I would think so. Nah. Well, it is not a good situation there. The state senator I mentioned earlier, and I will mispronounce her name. Let me read it again. She's from the St. Louis area. Senator Jamila Nasheed is one who has said that the prosecuting attorney in St. Louis County is not qualified because he did not receive a majority of the black vote in the last election. And that was on Megyn Kelly on Fox News.
What page is that on?
Well, you can find it on FoxNewsInsider.com.
No, I mean, where did she read that law at?
Yeah,
of the law book, what page is it on?
Yeah.
Apparently, whichever one she wrote, not the one they're using. Yeah.
It's just amazing some of the stuff that they come out with. And in their mind, they think they're right about those things.
Yeah.
And that's unfortunate. That they're not serving the people, their constituents, the people that elected them in a fair and equitable manner, I don't believe.
No, I don't believe so either. Dave, are you back there?
I'm back. I don't know what that annoying sound is, but we're going to live with it until it goes away.
I don't either, but I am going to go away a minute and come right back and see if that will kind of reboot on my end.
Okay.
Okay.
Well,
right,
Jerry, you're what's Voice of the Ozarks?
Voice of the Ozarks is a bunch of conservative individuals, a group of like-minded individuals who feel that the National Park Service is exerting their authority over our individual rights, our inalienable rights. And we came together about 7 years ago, and we have been on the other side of the fence from the Park Service for 7 years, and every time they've come out with some sort of action, we've tried to counter that action if we felt it was oppressive. It's our opinion that bureaucracies, most federal bureaucracies, they're like cancer. They continue to grow, and that's what's important to them, our growth. Make our budget bigger, let us hire more people, let us make more money. Providing a service to the public is not in their wildest imagination. They just want to do what they got to do to draw that paycheck and get along. And we resent that at Voice of the Ozarks. The Park Service came into our area in 1964, and they bought what they could buy, and what they couldn't buy, they took through eminent domain. And even though that was 50 years ago, there's still a lot of hard feelings among people who have lived here all their lives. These people are English, Irish, Scotch. They came here and settled a long time ago. And they came here because they were fleeing oppression from Great Britain. And they may have landed in North or South Carolina and migrated through Tennessee and ended up here in Missouri. But their one motive was, I don't want the government looking over my shoulder. And that's still the way these people feel. And the National Park Service has come to this area of the Ozarks since 1964, and continually, habitually, they have taken individual rights away as far as use of this land, use of this river. Their main mission statement back in 1964, when they decided they were going to make this a riverway, and it's not a national park now, It's a scenic riverway. It's the only one in the United States. But their main mission statement when they started it was, we want to guarantee that the public has access to this river, to these lands, and that private property owners don't, private property owners don't bar the public from the use of this land and this water. And lo and behold, inch by inch, step by step, as Larry Mullen Curley would say, they've taken rights away. They've done exactly what they were, their mission statement said they were going to try and prevent. And that's upsetting. Very upsetting.
Okay. And what does VOO do about it?
Well, we're a watchdog. We cry wolf when something's going on. We rally the public. As you know, the public can be apathetic about certain things, and until they feel threatened, they won't rise up and complain and go to meetings and gather and send in comment cards. And so every time the Park Service initiates a new action that we feel is intrusive, we get on the horn, we get into the media, whatever way we can, we spread the word.
How do people follow you?
When they're threatening their rights, they follow us well, extremely well. We have a website, VOTOZARKS.org, VOTOZARKS.org.
Okay, VOTOZARKS.org.
Correct.
Okay, so people should tune in there and you'll keep us abreast of what's going on.
Sure, and they'll read. We issue public statements through various newspapers and radio shows. They'll hear from us when we think there's, like the Blue Way that was proposed a while back, the 13-county heritage area. Those things, we reared up against those things because we felt like the government was once again trying to be over-intrusive. Now, they never quit. They just go back, regroup, and come at you with a new name and a new slant to their objective. And that's readily apparent.
Right now, a lot of the same things they were trying to do with the Blue Way, the EPA is trying to do using the state's Department of Natural Resources as an enforcement arm. That's something that Gary's group and a lot of others are keeping an eye on. They seem to be kind of on hold at the moment, as the Park Service does. At least I've not heard anything from the Park Service. Gary, have you on their decision?
Well, a few weeks ago, there was a Kansas City reporter that called me, and he wanted to do an interview. And at the time, I'd injured myself, and I wasn't really feeling up to an interview. So I sent him on to another board member, and he took a ride down the current river, and he interviewed some local citizenry. He interviewed our board member. He interviewed several Park Service employees, as well as the superintendent of the Park Service, and then he wrote his article. And in his article, he mentioned that, park rangers haven't had any houses burned down yet, and he said that the park rangers go into restaurants, and people stare at them, and they hear mutterings. And, I mean, he got this information from Park Service employees, I would assume. But what I got out of his article, it was a little left-leaning, I thought, but what I got out of it was that they actually fear us. And I can't see why you would fear people that you're supposed to be serving. But once again, just like what we talked about in Ferguson, there's a line there. The police are on one side and the public's on the other, and it becomes confrontational because there's a line there. And I think the Park Service is feeling that there's a line been drawn and that there's a confrontation there. If you ask them about the land that they obtained through eminent domains and other means, they'll say, well, they'll refer to it as Park Service land. And I question that, and I say, Park Service land. This is our land. We the people. We own this land. You work for us. You'll never get them to admit that. Never.
No,
it's amazing.
Never.
We had a meeting with them in the Eminence High School, and they came in with all their charts and their smiles, and they brought six or eight park rangers in there armed. And I questioned them because I have a little bit of experience with the law, although I'm not an expert in Missouri law. I said, why are you wearing guns on school property? It's my understanding that you can't wear guns on school. Well, we're on duty. I said, on duty, do you have any authority here on this property? And they wouldn't answer that question. I said, I think you're in violation of state law. And
they had a series of meetings back in, I was going to say they had a series of meetings. Was that in January and February, Jerry, those were going on?
Yeah, I think it was January, maybe March, but January, right in there.
Yeah, one of them was in Van Buren. It was sponsored by the Park Service. There had been a meeting in Thayer that our PRC group had sponsored just a few weeks earlier. We'd invited the head of the Park Service. He did not come. His excuse was he didn't have money for transportation, so we offered to buy a tank of gas. Get him there?
Get him there.
He turned that down and said they did not have all the people in their office were on vacation, basically. And they were supposedly broke. But when we went to the meeting in Van Buren, they had, what was it, six or seven people that they'd flown in from Omaha and Denver at government expense.
Put them up
and,
in the local hotel there.
Uh-huh.
Just
and,
the meeting, actually.
When you talked, you were pointing that out, and they seemed a little bit embarrassed by that. You know, but we were getting all kinds of flim-flam from them. I remember I asked of the 400 people there how many were for the new Park Service rules by show of hands. And I said, if you are not a Park Service employee or an employee of Senator McCaskill, and there were only three people who were in favor, the other 397 were against. So it's obvious that people want the Park Service to back off.
Well, what you have to realize, and you can analyze what's going on at Ferguson, or you can analyze what I've just spoken about, and you'll find a common denominator there. And the common denominator is that the federal government does not think that the state and local government is competent. They don't trust them, and they think that they have to be the ultimate authority. And my question is, who's watching them? Who is watching them?
Who is watching the watchers? Yeah.
I mean, when the police department, we had internal affairs, we had a security squad, we had FBI, if it was a civil rights violation, as in this case they're claiming it is, we had all those people looking over our shoulder. But when the FBI or the DEA or any federal law enforcement to speak of, when they are suspect in a crime or a misstep, shall we say, they have an internal division of their own, which is their own people.
Mm-hmm.
And it just amazes me at the attitude that they take. Like, I'm sure if you spoke to a lot of those FBI agents, those 40 FBI agents in Ferguson, we need to hang this guy. We need to hang this guy. And that just angers me to no end that the federal government is so almighty.
Well,
you know, my God is not in Washington.
Yeah. They're there. They have to justify their existence. And there's an old saying, if all you have is a hammer, every problem looks like a nail. You know, they're wanting to use the authority they have on the civil rights violations to justify being there. Nah, but we don't know. We weren't there. We don't know exactly what happened in Ferguson. I think one of the most important things is for people to be patient and see what comes out. and be open-minded. And we're not getting very much of that from some of our elected officials right now. The governor and the, the folks he has appointed and our attorney general. So,
this will be a long, drawn-out process, and I'll guarantee one thing. It's going, the temperature is going to fall a bunch of degrees before they come out with any immediate decisions, so to speak. They want things to cool down.
Yeah. Got Keith Carmichael on hold. Keith, do you want to make some comments on Ferguson or a different topic?
Can you hear me all right?
Yeah, hear you fine.
Hey, fantastic. I just have to tell a little bit, I don't know, I can't say there's a lot of similarities between Ferguson and what I actually grew up in between the 11 Point and the current rivers. You know, where my wife is from Wilderness, and most of those, a lot of those families are employees of the Forest Service and local people who have grown up there. I remember when they took eminent domain and went down the 11 Point River and took out communities. I wasn't very old, but I know the men along the 11 Point, the people who lived there, the Hufstetlers, McGibneys, people who lived at Bowes Mill, where it was 35 homes. They fought. They spent a lot of their own money. They got absolutely no, I mean, you know, over the years, the federal government was a steamroller, and when they have hearings and have people come in, that process just has one purpose, and that is to let people vent. Those bureaucrats have absolutely no intention of listening or taking in anything that you have to say. Most of the time, they've already made up their minds. They've got a plan. They've got a schedule, and you're just in the way.
Oh, yeah. Jerry, your group sent 5,000 postcards at one time for comments.
That's right, and then they changed. They decided they'd do it. They analyzed the data a little differently and threw all those out.
Mm-hmm. They didn't like the results they were getting, so they changed the rules in midstream.
Right. They hired a firm out of Las Vegas to come into Salem, Missouri, and conduct a workshop, and they invited 40 people. They handpicked 40 people that they thought they could get the appropriate results from and had them come into the workshop, and they had facilitators in each group, if you're familiar with that, to kind of guide the discussion.
Delphi technique?
Yeah.
Delphi technique being used.
Yeah. And that's that, and still they didn't get the results that they wanted. And this latest thing we were talking about earlier this year, I understand they had 4,000 comments on that, and they don't like what they say.
Mm-hmm.
But the man, the guy that just spoke, he's absolutely correct. They have their mind made up. They're just there to say what they're really having these meetings for. Is there's I can't remember the acronym for the piece, but there's a statute, so to speak, that says that they must solicit input from the community before they take any action, and they're trying to fulfill that without really doing anything. That's what he was absolutely correct. That's exactly where they're coming from. They mean to do what they mean to do. And if you raise enough cane about it, well, we'll wait a little while, and we'll come back and do it later.
You know, one of the good things that really came out of the Blue Way incident is the good guys won for once, at least temporarily. And we did it with what we have probably 15 to 20 grassroots groups in Missouri and probably a dozen in Arkansas.
That's right. They all came together.
Absolutely. We had Secure Arkansas was a pretty large group, the Fulton County Patriots, the Tea Party groups down there. A lot of Republicans and Democrats both who were independent but liberty-minded in Arkansas. In Missouri, we had Voice of the Ozarks, the Property Rights Coalitions,
Campaign for Liberty, the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, the Constitution Party, the Libertarian Party, a big group of Republicans. There might have been some Democrats there. I didn't notice any, but who knows? They might have been there, too. And, you know, we all yelled so darn loud. Oh, there was a Tea Party group that was working with us out of Shell Knob. We all yelled so loud that then the elected officials were listening, and then they jumped in and started yelling. And we wound up with 20 of the 21 affected counties in Missouri, and I think all of the affected counties in Arkansas. Their county commissions or quorum courts in Arkansas signing letters rejecting it. And I have talked to people in other states who are liberty-minded who are very familiar with that and have pointed that out and said, you know, the guys in the Ozarks, you know, set a good example for the rest of the country. So, you know, a pat on the back to everyone out there that was involved in that fight. And,
the government will make the decisions for you, and they will not make decisions that are favorable for you. They will make decisions that they want to make. If you stand up
exactly.
and be counted, then you've got an opportunity to slow this thing up, because if it doesn't get slowed up before long, the country that we love so dearly is doomed.
Are you there?
I am.
Okay.
We're all here. We're having some kind of a technical problem, a little
yeah, we
background
are.
Noise.
We're up against a break. We want to thank Jerry King, retired Memphis colonel, colonel with the Memphis Police Department, current chairman of Voice of the Ozarks, VOTOzarks.org, Jerry, or .com?
Org.
VOTOzarks.org. We want to thank Kevin Jocks, who was with us earlier. He's retired from the LAPD. He is currently chief of police at Summersville. We're going to take a break. We'll be right back, and we'll take on the second part of our show this upcoming, and I say upcoming, Convention of the States.
To cold climb, come spring. So let me hear you say, my love, I'm gonna stand my ground. They rise to me and blow them down. I am gonna stand my ground.
No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
You go fast and wrong for right and right for wrong. People on the stand for that for just so long. I don't have the gift of the prophecy, telling everybody how it's gonna be. There's a wildfire catching in the whip of the wind. It's not a complication like this, it's never
fire, brothers and sisters. We're going to talk now, and Keith Carmichael chimed in this wasn't pre-planned by me, but Keith chimed in at just the right time. We've got a lot of people tuned in tonight. We're at 347-677-1835, 347-677-1835, and I put out a question today to all of my friends, good friends, who are opposed to a convention of the states. Some good conservative people who, for some reason or other, still don't like the idea of the citizens of this country taking the reins back, of the states taking back control of their federal government. And my question to them, and my question to you folks listening tonight, if you want to weigh in on this, is when this happens, and it's going to happen, what are you going to do? I understand that until it happens, you feel like you need to stand your ground. You feel like you need to make your case, and I appreciate that. Make it. But this thing's going to happen, and when it does, my question for you is, what will you do? Will you sit on your hands, or will you join in at that time? Keith, you have some news for us?
Sure do. I just want to say good evening, and I hope you mentioned something about folks who are still not comfortable with this idea, and you know, with the information that's been out there for so long, and there's really no wonder that there's reservation on many fronts about this. I think the leftists who first come up with this whole idea of a runaway convention and putting doubt and fear in people's minds, I think they'd be surprised today that a number of conservatives have fallen into that trap. But that's okay. I think I've learned recently that there are a number of people I really respect that I've talked to recently, and I let them know that if they're have reservation about this process and in Article 5, that second part that the founders gave us, the actual rudder of our federalism, that they're in good company, because if you could go right down the list of proponents today, people who are at the top of the list, from Robert G. Nadelson to Senator Mike Lee to Mark Meckler himself, Convention of States Citizen for Self-Government. You can go right down the list. Every one of those people. I think Sam Colburn, Senator Sam Colburn from Oklahoma, Rand Paul, Ted Cruz, right down the list. Ken Cuccinelli, all of these people, you're in good company because they all started there, but they went and did their research. They went back and said, you know, let's take another look at this, a fresh look. And when they did, you know, they found that this is, you know, I sometimes would use the example of a veto, presidential veto. If, you know, obviously we've used that over the course of the last 230-some years. The president's used it a number of times. But if he had never used it, if it's something that's there to balance power in the Constitution, and if it had never been used, and if there are people who said, you know, we just can't use that because the wheels will fall off, it would be just as laughable. If the founders were here with us today, they would find that position, looking at this core mechanism they gave us to balance power. You know, if you'd be in a boat for 230 years and you've never touched the steering, it wouldn't be any wonder that you're lost, that you're off course and you're in no man's land, they would say, you know, the quicker you use it, the more. George Mason said it needs to be easy, regular, and constitutional. And I think it's going to happen. I agree with you. I hope that people will go to conventionofstates.com and get involved, because as I told gentlemen this last weekend, well-respected conservative man, he said, you know, this will never work unless you have, and he started going through what had to happen. And it was as if he had been in the planning meetings. He'd never been on the conference call or in any of the meetings with Convention of States and leaders. But when he laid out the plan, this is the only way this will work. And he just laid it out. And I said, that's exactly what the plan is, to have an organization, a grassroots organization, in every House district. And I understand if people, why people might be worried if they thought we were going to call a convention and then set back on our laurels and go back to letting someone else do self-governance. But that's not the plan. The plan is to have an organization where we're looking over the shoulder with our hand on the back of our legislators, encouraging them and giving them some guidance as they select delegates to this convention, because it will happen, as they frame the rules and put that in the rules, as they ratify amendments. We can't go away. Self-governance, we better wake up and keep on course, because that's how we got here in the first place, is not paying attention. And so that's what our plan is. And every House district, every county, to have people who are willing to stand up. And I just tell people who have those reservations, I said, we need you on our team, because there's going to be a time we're going to be selecting delegates, and we need your wisdom. We need your reservation to balance out those of us who are kind of idealistic and in a hurry. We need everybody on our team.
So that's the question for you listeners out there. 347-677-1835, 347-677-1835. I want to hear from some of you tonight, because and we're not here to argue with you. I'm not here to try to convince you. I fully expect you to stand your ground until such time that a convention is called. You have a case. You believe in your case, and you make your case. You make it quite fluently. You make it quite eloquently. And you believe in it. So I fully expect you to stand your ground until such time as the convention of the states becomes a reality. My question to you is, when it becomes a reality, are you then prepared to help us select good delegates? Are you then prepared to help us keep it from becoming what you fear it will become?
It's the people's process. It's the people's
Mike?
Process to take up, and it's not a. You know, the founders had great vision. They were brilliant in putting our future, the balance of the republic, in the hands of state legislatures and state legislators. But those people, they work for us, and if we're not paying attention. You know, then we're going to get the government that we deserve, and we get the convention we deserve if we are not on board. Now, I mentioned that I had some news. You mentioned there's people who are against this. Interesting enough, we have a huge coalition this week between AMAC and the Convention of States. AMAC is the conservative counterpart, as you know, to AARP. They have 1.2 million members, 650,000 households, and they are completely on the record in favor of Convention of States. They're going through a series of training with all their members, and they're on board for any time we need a call to action. We have them at our, I mean, they're ready. Now, interesting well, enough, they put the question on their website a few weeks ago, and you know, all of the Convention of States staff, state leaders were told about it, but we were all given strict instructions to not go on that poll, not go on that site. I mean, go on the site and watch it, but do not vote. This is an AMAC poll of their members. So we had strict instructions. We want this to be pure. We don't want it to be tainted in any way. So we did. We watched it. And I kind of forgot about it, kind of got busy. I found out that 97% of their membership is for Convention of States. 97%. Now, we ask them, are you comfortable with those numbers? And they said, well, we wondered about the numbers ourselves. So we put it in the mailer, and we sent it out to, they did a sample mailing. Several thousand members, same percentage, came back. 97% of the AMAC members are in favor of a convention of states. So I'm just saying, when you say this is inevitable, that's unreal percentages. You can't get 97% of people in any organization to agree on what color the room is, much less something that this big and this monumental. So we're just really honored. And I invite people, if you're not a member, I mean, AMAC is an organization that's 50 and over, and just look into their organization. It's AMAC, AMAC.us. And but they are the, I mean, for my money, AARP is nothing but a leftist front organization at this point. And these people are conservative-minded. They want to represent conservatives, and they're proving it. They're putting their reputation on the line and to prove it.
Keith, you had quite a crowd around you this weekend at the Expo. And you were in a nice spot between White Harvest Seed Company and Lynn Pence, the gardener. But, you know, you always had a crowd. What were people saying? What were they asking?
Well, we had a real mix. You know, we had some folks who were really had been excited, and they got to a point that they wanted to know more about it. They had some people who never heard of it. I've got to tell you, and I don't have the woman's name. I should, but I guess if I did have it, I probably would be reserve and sharing her name. She came by when my brother was there. She's nearly 85 years old. I don't know the exact number. She might be just over 80, but she's in her 80s. I think my brother said she's 85. I didn't get a chance to meet her, but he tells me this story. She's lost her husband. She's over 80 years old. And after the 2008 election, 2012 election, she was absolutely sick. And she resolved to do something every day to make a difference in the future of her children in this country. And I just found that to be an enormous inspiration. I mean, I looked at a picture that I have on my computer screen of men walking out of a Higgins boat and walking onto the beaches of Omaha Beach. And, you know, a lot of those people didn't come back. We can call a convention, for better or for worse, we can call a convention and we can take back the direction of this country. Mike, there's all kinds of people, and we had lots of folks who signed our petition, and you can go on conventionofstates.com if you want to do that online. Basically, it's just a letter to your legislator that lets them know that you'd like them to consider and seriously consider an application in Missouri for a convention of states, Article 5 convention of states. And, I think
this will be brought up in the legislature next session.
Yeah, I think there's a pre-file ready, isn't it? Isn't there, Keith?
There's a strategy. We've got some folks who are, you know, we kind of had to get past August 5th, and then we're gonna have several meetings in October. But as we get past a November election, we'll move in and certainly be pre-filing both and work towards that. I don't think, you know, I know there's going to be a lot of states. It's going to be a lot heavier lifting than Missouri. I look around for people who are ready for a change, and I have to tell you, I found them in the Capitol because they have a front row seat. A lot of them do. The ones that, especially the ones that we talked to the first few days, and they were all either sponsor or co-sponsors of that resolution. And those people that we talked to, they realize that Missouri, in every state, all states are becoming agencies of a federal government, and as state legislators, they see that every day. And that's where I found people who are ready for a change. And
I have friends who are opposed to the COS who always say that the federal government does not follow the Constitution now. Why should we think they would follow it if it were
changed?
We get that question a lot. In fact, we get it so often you can go on to conventionofspace.com and you can see frequently asked questions, and that may be the top one. That may be the top question. History shows us that when amendments, in fact, there's a great article by Robert G. Nadelson, came out in March, and the title of it is Constitutional Amendments Work. His point is, if you go back and look at what they were, you know, the many of those that we have today that have been ratified, and what they were designed to do, some of them were designed to correct court cases that were way online, and they've done that. Some have been, for example, nobody's talking about giving the president another term. That was very effective in limiting the president's 2 terms, and that's what it does, and there's others. But the point is new constitutional amendments that are newly adopted give us they have longevity because of the political power that requires 38 states to ratify any issue. That ratification process, you know, there's just going to be people, it's fresh on their minds. Nobody's going to say that the Second Amendment has protected our right to keep and bear arms for 230 plus years. It has. Is it being pushed on every day? Absolutely. But just think for just a second where we would be without it. So, yes, they're not following some things. There are things who definitely can be clarified relatively easily and give us another 100 years.
I want to answer that question too, Mike. Restate it so that all the listeners are sure what we're talking about here.
Well, many of my friends say that since the federal government does not follow the Constitution anyway as it exists now, adding amendments would not do any good because they're not following what we have.
Your friends are correct. The federal government does not follow the Constitution that we have right now, and I cringe. I cringe when I hear people – I'm sorry, Keith, but you used this phrase earlier, but I hear it all the time – talk about a convention of the states being a part of the balance of power. We are not talking, brothers and sisters, about a balance of power. We're not interested in a balance of power. We're taken over. We're taking the power. That's what these amendments do. Repeal the 17th Amendment. Put the Senate back in the hands of the states and give the states back the power. Repeal the 16th Amendment. Take the power of income taxation away from the federal government. And introduce an amendment that allows states, through the state repeal amendment, to overturn anything and everything the federal government does. Then the Constitution once again becomes a power of the states. And we don't care that the federal government doesn't follow the Constitution because it's not their Constitution anymore, it's ours. And they will do, at that point, what we tell them. Only those 3 amendments will fix that problem, Mike. We're not talking about sharing power with the federal government. We're talking about taking over.
Okay.
Well, the truth is, and I agree with Mark Levin when he says in his book, Liberty Amendments, that we are living at this point. We are living today. We're living right now in a post-constitutional America. Someone says, well, you know, you're right there. I really believe what you said. In many ways, I agree. They've already taken over. We're looking at death throes of a republic. Now, I do have a friend that used to say it's not ever quite as bad as you think it is, and it's not ever quite as good as you think it is. It's somewhere in the middle. I had some folks come up, Mike, when you asked me what some people had to say. There were a handful that said, you know, I believe we're too far gone. I don't think that we can ever fix this problem that we have. And I said, well, I looked down, and this one gentleman had a smartphone, and I said, let me see your phone. And he looked at me kind of puzzled, and I said, he had trouble getting it, so I picked mine up, and I turned mine on, and I said, do you have any of these on your phone? And I showed him a picture of my granddaughter, who will be 20, who will be 30 years old in 2040. And I said, you know, I'm just not ready to look her in the face, in the eye, and say, Hadley, there will never be an America for you to grow up in. It's gone. Now, that gentleman may be right. By God and with God's power, I'm not ready to throw in the towel, and I know a lot of other folks are not ready. And we owe it to our children, and we owe it to the framers of the Constitution to use the tool that they put in their Constitution 2 days before they adjourned, and they not only inserted it with unanimous approval in ratification debates and writings and the Federalist Papers. It was their final closing argument. They promised it to be a remedy for what we have today, a coercive, overbearing, out-of-control federal government. And I say we take them at their word one more time.
Okay. Now, there are a few conservative groups out there that are opposed to this idea. The John Birch Society, for instance. Pardon me. Why do you think these groups are opposed?
Let me address that. And this is really interesting because if you look at history, now, when I talk to people and I explain to them that what I'm about to say, I find some very hungry for the truth, and they will go find it. They'll go do the research. And then I find some people who are just lazy, and they're regurgitating something that they've heard, and they're not going to go do research, and they're not really interested in finding out what the truth is. They just want to go on and on. And for those folks, I say, you know, God bless you. But I'm really looking for people. My only purpose at this point is not to convince anybody of anything, but to encourage people to go find out for yourself, because the answer to your question is all of that information before 1979, and that's what this whole idea was based on, commentaries and so-called scholarship before 1979. I can give you a long bibliography of the people who wrote about Article 5. And Robert G. Nadelson said when he came to it, he's written on nearly every other part of the Constitution, and he's never done any study of Article 5. And so he came to Article 5, and he said what he found was not only was there not very much written about Article 5, but he found it to be completely wrong. In fact, he found himself to be on the wrong side of history and on the wrong side of facts. And he said, I used to believe this and this and this, and you know what? I was wrong. He said, it's not what being wrong, it's what you think you are when you're right is not true. And my point is those people who wrote prior to 1979, many of them had an agenda. They weren't scholars. They list their bibliography. They list their sources. And they're devoid of most of the real sources that entail what it means to have scholarship on this issue. Not only have they in many cases, ran aground, but in order to run aground, they had to make up other things along the way. Unfortunately, some conservative groups picked this up way back there, John Birch Society being one. The whole idea of the Philadelphia Convention being a runaway convention is a ruse. RUSE. It's a tactic. It's a tactic used by the left, and we know who invented it. We can go back and read their writings.
Wait, no, are you saying that our convention in Philadelphia that came up with the Constitution was not a runaway convention?
we might that might be a topic that we need to really go back and study, and we can spend the whole show on it. But what we've learned is that there was commissioners there. They had commissions. They had been given authority to do certain things, and only two states did not have those have that authority to do that. And those folks, they went home. And Alexander Hamilton stayed from the New York delegation, but he didn't vote. He signed it as a citizen. And we can go back and, it's part of history that's been gone over several times. But
And I had a lot of history in college, and it was my understanding that they were there to revise the Articles of Confederation and took upon themselves the power to create the new Constitution.
Well, in order to get that cleared, you have to go back to the Annapolis Convention and see, first of all, that those states met there not from any authority of the Congress at the time. Congress didn't have power to do that. Congress had no power. And if you look at what they actually did, they said they used words they used words that were hollow because they didn't have power to do anything. Those states were there because of their power, their sovereign power as states. So we can go back and spend more time on this, but the truth is beginning in about 1980, we have a book written by Russell Kaplan called Constitutional Brinkmanship. Now, this scholarship can be divided in three waves. The first wave is primarily before 1979. It has been reduced to mere fiction. Robert G. Nadelson calls it science fiction in some of his writings. But the idea is that there is scholarship and then there's fiction. And people who have an agenda don't have the credibility of people who are studying this years later with no axe to grind and who are honest scholarship and list all of their sources and go back and study all of the sources, not just part. But the second wave would include Russell Kaplan's book, and then the third wave would be out this side of 2010, and there's been enormous amount of work done on it by the Goldwater Foundation and a number of individuals, but Robert G. Nadelson primarily, and no one doubts that he has came to it with an objective view, and he'll tell you that he found himself to be wrong many, many times. Now, another little story about Robert G. Nadelson, he's an individual who he wanted to always learn Latin, and his dad told him Latin was for sissies. So finally, after being married to his wife for years and years, she said, you're going to either have to go learn Latin or just quit talking about it. So he went and taught himself Latin. And to a certain degree to which he now has a self-taught master's in the language, which gives him an insight into the writings, the letters, the discourse of the founders that someone who doesn't understand that language doesn't really have today, because that was a second language for those men. They used it. And so we today, to us, it's a lost language. Many of us, we don't even... we're not familiar with it at all. But he self-taught himself that language as an adult and now has the certification. And so that gives him a little more credibility in my mind over anybody else that's written about it.
I'm really confused now. I've read everything I could get my hands on that was correspondence between the founders. I've read all of the papers that they wrote to the maximum extent I know they exist. I don't recall seeing anything written in Latin, Keith.
Not entire documents. We're talking about phrases. And you'll come across phrases in their personal communication that helps you understand their state of mind and the concepts that they really, what they had in mind. And a number of our, we use laissez-faire, we use all these, there's all kinds of phrases that to us are foreign, and we have to go look them up. But they didn't go look them up. They use them in every day.
Okay. Well, I'm, you know, I'm going to weigh in a little bit. I mean, I'm going to weigh in totally in favor of a convention of the states, as I have always been, long before Mark Levin caught on to it. I'm going to weigh in as a proponent of the people taking over the government through amendments to the Constitution. But I'm going to suggest that everyone here do exactly what Keith said and go do the research. Keith, when you go do the research, you do not in fact find that 10 states sent commissioners to Philadelphia with permission to change the Constitution or to change to dump the Articles of Confederation and adopt a new Constitution.
Well, interesting enough, in Patrick Henry College, we got to see the in his library revolutionary publications that were on microfiche, I guess. It was, you know, unbelievable how old it was, and they've done some research in some of those publications just fairly recently that are really, it's really interesting. I'm not going to say it's any game-changing. I'm not the expert on that, and I'm going to rely on those people who've studied it all their lives. And you know, I've done other things for the last 30 years, and those people who have spent their lives studying it, put their reputation on the line, have explained this a couple different, you know, various symposiums, in articles, and I'll leave them to testify about that. And there are people like yourself, Lloyd Sloan, and others who are brilliant people who have a lot of knowledge of the period and of the history, and dwarf me by far. So I'm not going to be one of those people that are going to talk and try to sound like an expert, because I'll just be honest and say I'm going to leave that in the hands of those people who've studied a lot longer than I have. But it just makes sense to me. We give these men credit. We say that by their own word and by their own testimony, they couldn't have done in Philadelphia what they did unless they had some guiding hand of providence. I know not everyone believes that. I personally do. And by their own testimony, they couldn't, many of them have said that. And so let's give that document that has brought us thus far. You know, if you're going to embrace the Constitution, I think we're required to embrace all of it, not just part of it. And I've said this before, we have the Constitution, and for some reason we, because of fear, for any other reason, are not willing to use Article 5, then we don't have the whole Constitution, and that's not the Constitution that we've sworn an oath, many have sworn an oath to uphold and defend.
I agree with everything you just said, Keith, 100%. The Constitution was a great document. It was a great effort made by the people in Philadelphia, and we're lucky to have it. We were lucky to have them, and we're lucky to have it, and I've never argued that point at all. And I agree with you. We need to use the whole thing. It's time to use Article 5. It's time for the people to take their government back. I don't fear, and that's why I insist that we address this openly and in discourse and honest debate. I don't fear the way some of those people who talk about this fear the whole open convention thing. There is no need to fear it. We are a government of, by, and for all of the people, and as such, you know, I mean, quite frankly, when it comes to socialism as a form of economics and as a form of government, if 3/4 of the states are ready to ratify that, we're lost anyway.
Well, let's talk about some amendments that we think would ratify relatively quickly. Some people say, well, you guys just don't have a plan. And I say, well, you know that how? You've been at the meetings and you've been on these hundreds of conference calls? No, you haven't, so you don't know what you're talking about. But, yes, let's talk about some of the amendments that I think if they they'd have to be proposed. But I think, you know, sometimes we may start small and work our way up. But I told some folks that, you know, you wouldn't think you'd have to make a constitutional amendment that says you have to read bills before you actually pass them. But as long as we send children from some locations to represent people, then maybe that needs to be in there. But certainly, more importantly, seriously, bills that come from to Congress need to be one topic. No more omnibus bills, 2,800 pages or whatever. They need to be about one topic. You send a representative up there, I don't care if he's smart or she's not smart. You know, you send people up there you trust because they're intelligent. But if they have 15 different topics all rammed in one bill and they have some things they're for and some things they're... That's not representation. And that's not governing. There's another word for it. And bills could be single topic. All amendments have to be related to the topic. And if you submit a bill or if you submit a bill that's not or you submit an amendment that's not germane, then you're done for the year. You don't get any more bills, and you don't get any more amendments. And so simply putting the brakes on those kind of things would be just the beginning, a common-sense thing that could be ratified in 38 states and I think in a heartbeat. Other things, I tell you what, now I cross the state of Missouri and I talk to all kinds of people, and they all have one thing in common. They all think, you know, some of them have education, some of them are not educated, but they all know what fairness is. And there's absolutely nothing fair about a congressman or congresswoman going up and serving one term and having a golden lifetime retirement parachute. There's no fairness in that. And if it takes a constitutional amendment, I'm not suggesting that that should, but that's the kind of thing that people are really, that really irks a lot of Americans. And more importantly, there's things that have to be done. If we don't balance a budget in the first convention, then we're done. We're Venezuela. Now, I may be wrong, but the people I've talked to said we don't have that much time. And
you're talking about a balanced budget amendment?
Absolutely. But one that has teeth in it, one that's tied to GDP, one that's tied to where they can't. You know, if you don't pass a balanced budget, you know, then your next year's budget is minus 5%. You go from there. But
you know,
tie
Keith,
it to a lot of things.
This is kind of like UFOs. I want to believe. All right. But part of my problem, and I'm on the fence here. I've told some people, if you convince me you've got enough safeguards and you go after specific amendments like the 17th repealed, Madison's lost amendment put in,
absolutely,
I can see myself leaning towards it. But the thing that stops me from taking that leap always is I don't trust politicians. I don't trust our elected officials. There are a few I like that have been straight shooters with me, very few. But the majority, you know, whenever they get in a herd, I don't trust them. Look at the crap they do in Jeff City in Washington, D.C. every day.
Yep.
So
let me ask you a question. Which one do you want to trust more, the ones in Washington or the ones that you know where they live here in Missouri and you can at least put your hand on their shoulder and say, you know, what
well,
do you
get
think?
Get the hand on their throat here when they're close, but it doesn't mean I trust them.
I'm a hand
either.
On the shoulder guy. I'm not a hand on the throat yet. I've not been that far.
I was telling a state rep the other day that we were approaching the point where he's going to see people with pitchforks and torches around the Capitol, and I'm about 90% serious on that.
Yep.
People are pretty upset. But,
I have,
you know, that's the one thing that stops me, though. I just don't know that I can trust him.
I flash back to a discussion that we had here 2 or 3 weeks ago when we were talking about the problem that we have with the Supreme Court. And the problem we have with the Supreme Court is as I believe it was Lloyd mentioned, You know, what you have in that situation is the federal government deciding whether something the federal government is doing is in fact something the federal government can do. So you got the federal government going out here doing something, and then the arbiter of whether the federal government can do that is the federal government. So
that's what, exactly. That's one of my suggestions that I heard about was one of the best.
That brings me to a question of if how does an amendment that limits a bill to one topic help reduce the power of the federal government? Because when you're sitting in the House of Representatives, when you're sitting in the United States Senate, and someone introduces a bill that is a agricultural bill and a food stamp bill, who decides that that's only one topic or that that's two topics? The United States Senate. They have a parliamentarian. Someone stands up and says, I object, that's not germane. They have a vote, and they decide whether it's one or two subjects.
I understand, and I don't disagree. Missouri is supposed to have a rule. They get around it about every way they can. They have a name for it. Let's back up to the Supreme Court for just a second. I know Mark Levin talks about Supreme Court justices, you know, no more lifetime appointments, in fact, term limits. It took me a long time to warm up to this idea, that the more I hear about it, the more I've heard it several times from the same person. And finally, I said, you know, the European example, I don't like European examples, but they have an example where, the way it would translate here is that every state would have a Supreme Court justice. And that would be, they wouldn't all sit at one time. They would have a rotation. They would usually sit nine at a time, and then they would rotate different. But my point is they would be selected by the states. And that would solve exactly what you're talking about there, as long as those people that were selected by a process in which we give a state sovereignty, state rights type constitutional-minded person to go up there. But were that the case, you'd have one from Kansas and one from Arkansas and one from Missouri. Nobody's going to say that it's going to be a perfect system, but they'd have some type of limited term. But it would be better than what we have now, where they're colluding with Congress, where the president, you know, is hoping one will die in his term or two will die so he can stack the court. You know,
yep.
To me, I heard thing is when those folks go in that meeting, there'll be a number of suggestions that will not hold water, that will not get support. They may not get a second. They certainly don't get a positive vote by 26 states. But one that I thought was radical the first time I heard it, and the second time, the third time I heard it, started to make more sense all the time. And that is, you know, not only do we repeal the 17th Amendment, I don't personally think that will happen on the first convention. I think it will take easy, regular meetings every so often. I think the second or third time when states really wake up that they have the power, and this is not hard, and there isn't a runaway, they'll figure it out and they'll get some things done. But the idea of taking our two senators and bringing them home and putting them in the office, putting their offices in the state capitol in Jefferson City, and if lobbyists want to get to them, they've got to walk by all of the state representatives' offices in order to get there to them. And if they forget what the 10th Amendment is about, some of our state representatives, who probably don't know what that is, but they should, to walk down the hallway and remind them. And they can do their business on a secure line on gotomeeting.com.
I don't have any problem with that. What is interesting to note, and I'm not voicing this as any opposition to thinking about or considering an amendment that would restrict the terms of Supreme Court justices, or as you say, even completely change the structure. But the idea that chief justices are are appointed for life, and changing that doesn't require a constitutional amendment. There's nothing in the Constitution that says a Supreme Court justice serves for life. That's in the Federal Judiciary Act, which we could change with just a law.
And nothing says there has to be 9 judges. Roosevelt tried to stack the deck with what he wanted, 40 or 50.
But after the collusion for 80 years that we've seen, that and this situation where the states have no representation in the court, where states are going and they passed statewide, the word escapes me, but California decides that marriage is between a man and a woman. Missouri decides that they're going to put term limits on their federal officials, and if a federal judge can come in and say, you know, all the citizens in California are the ones that the majority, they're wrong. It doesn't matter what you think. The federal judge can change that. Same way with, we voted 66% in Missouri, that 67% that we were against Obamacare, but we didn't get any other kind of voice. It didn't matter what Missourians thought, and that's the kind of thing that really irks folks, and they have no representation. And I think it's time.
All right.
Keith,
drop by any time. It's always great to talk to you. And keep us posted. Drop by weekly if you can to keep us updated on the news and how that's going. I've given everyone out there, and I'm sitting here looking at a board full of listeners. I guess they all agree that a convention of the states is a good thing, because none of them called in to say otherwise.
Keith, also thank you for participating in the expo last weekend. I appreciated you being there.
Really enjoyed it. That was a great crowd, and I was really educational in many ways. And I hope I can call in every week and have the kind of news that I had this evening. You know, it's not every day you get an organization like AMAC to come on board as a coalition partner and say we're on 100% and whatever you need. I hope I can bring some news like that every week, Dave.
That'd be great, and I think you will. I think this snowball is going to grow fast, and as I've said, it's not just a matter of if anymore. It's just a matter of when this thing is going to happen. I think states are ready for it. I believe the people are certainly ready for it, and we'll be watching it come about. Thanks, Keith. We'll talk to you soon.
Have a great evening. Thank you, guys.
Good night, my friend.
Good night.
Okay, Mike, another great show. Thanks very much to Jerry King, retired Memphis PD Colonel, chairman of the Voice of the Ozarks. That's VOTOzarks.org. Many thanks to Kevin Jotz, a retired LAPD detective, Medal of Valor winner down there in LAPD, current chief of police at Summersville. Good talk with both of those fellows. Less and less about the politics of what's going on the ground, and more about the reality of what's going on the ground in Ferguson, Missouri. Thanks to Keith Carmichael. Thanks to all our listeners. Listen up now. We'll be back tomorrow night, Mike and I. I haven't decided yet. We'll talk offline a little bit. I haven't decided yet what we'll talk about tomorrow night. It'll be fun. It'll be exciting. It'll be the best Saturday night you spend this week. And then on Tuesday night, Cynthia Davis comes along. And on Wednesday night, Lisa Payne Nager comes along with the Culture Vigilante. Those are both interesting shows, both at 7 o'clock. 7 o'clock Tuesday for Cynthia, 7 o'clock Wednesday for Lisa. And Mike and I will be back again next weekend on Friday and Saturday night with the State Sovereignty Hour, where we'll talk about all of the things that matter to states taking over. Once again, don't ever sit back and think that we are here to strike a balance of power with the federal government. This is about taking back the government that our founders gave us, a government of the states, a government of the sovereign people, putting the federal government back in its box. I'm telling you, everybody harps and harps about the magnificent writing of the Federalist Papers, about the justifications presented by three writers who were out making a case for adoption of the Constitution. And they are, in fact, profound masterpieces. But you cannot read them. You cannot read them and understand what's happened today without reading the Anti-Federalist Papers, where the founders, trying to keep the states from ratifying this Constitution as it stood, and they were not against a constitutional republic. They were against the Constitution the way it was written, and they harped and they preached and they said, this thing is going to become a monster. It's going to eat these states alive. It's going to become such a powerful entity, because that is the evolution of a government of humans, a government of mankind. They were right. They were right. One of the chiefest of the Anti-Federalists, George Mason, stood and gave us the answer on the next to the last day before the end of the convention and said, we've got to give the people, we've got to give the states the power to wrest control back away from the federal government. And Article 5 was written, Article 5 was incorporated in the Constitution, and Article 5 is there to do just exactly what has to be done today, not tomorrow. As Keith points out quite aptly, we don't have any more tomorrows. It is today or it's never. Mike, I love spending Friday and Saturdays with you. Thanks for coming along. It was great. Mike, by the way, folks, is the is my source of all these cool guests we have. He's friends with Jerry and Kevin, and he convinced them to come along tonight and give us a great little chat about
Kevin is also a co-chair of the Property Rights Coalition chapter we have in Thayer.
Oh.
And you know, didn't mention his Air Force career, but he actually guarded President Reagan when he was in Germany. So he's been around the block a few times.
Okay, Keith, we're out of time for tonight. I guess we better hang up and let these people get back to their ball game. It's almost over, by the way. It's the top of the ninth. The Cardinals are down to two outs, and they're losing to the last-place Phillies.
Uh-huh.
Yeah,
well,
not a good sign. Good night, Mike.
Bye-bye.
All right, good night.
All right. There are so many contradictions in all these messages we send. Keep asking, how do I get out of here? Where do I fit?